He goes, when the rain stops, I'm going to make an example of you.
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dicer.
The day a star fell, it was almost like...
like seeing something out of a dream. Nothing more or less than a breathtaking view.
Hello, everybody. It's Wreckatopia, episode 107. I am Chris Atkinson. Today's big recommend is Your Name, period. I'm joined today by Aaron Dicer.
Hi, Lee Ho, Cinerinos.
And Jeremy Scott.
Sup.
And the chat has come in today. Apparently, got a birthday today. Nick Jagger says birthday. His birthday. Says every year he tries to watch a movie he loves, and I'm so glad Aaron chose this one for today.
Oh, yeah, nice.
Definitely. So, does anybody have any small recommends?
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small. It's tiny. It's petite. It's wee.
I do. I seem to be on a string lately of accidentally myself into a recommend where I had something planned already for a recommend, but then I accidentally happened to watch a movie on Saturday that just kind of blew me away. And so that became my recommend. And it's a 1985 movie called Runaway Train, which I was sad to learn initially is not about the band Soul Asylum. this is John Voight and Eric Roberts. I had never heard of this movie. That may just be a blind spot for me in my film. In 1985, I was watching Back to the Future. I wasn't watching shit like this. Both of these men were nominated for an Academy Award. And this is a screenplay written by Akira Kurosawa. It's also the screen debut of Tiny Lister and Danny Trejo. John Voight is a notorious prisoner in an Alaskan prison. He's escaped twice. Because of it, they threw him in the hole for two straight years. And then some muckety-muck higher up in the government demands they take him out of the hole and put him back in Gen Pop. And of course, he escapes again. Every prisoner in this prison idolizes this guy. Eric Roberts, young Eric Roberts, is one of them and helps him escape, and they become this inadvertent pairing of escaped criminals. And basically, they get to this train yard. They hike for many, many miles in the snow. Again, it's Alaska. They get to this train yard, and there's a train of four locomotives that is about to take off, and it's obviously going to take some locomotives to another place so they can be used. And they steal some clothes and hop aboard this thing. A few minutes later, the engineer in the front locomotive has a heart attack and dies. And I don't really want to tell you much more about this, except to say that it has plenty of action, but it is not really an action movie at its heart. It is a philosophical movie about what makes you human, what makes you a monster. There are sharp emotional turns within 30 seconds in this movie a couple different times, but they work, they play. I was riveted the whole time because of the acting, not necessarily because of the situation. So there you go. I'd never heard of it. It's on Tubi for free right now. It's on Pluto. It's on MGM Plus. Really, really liked it. I talked about it so much, my wife is going to watch it. So there you go.
I had a friend of mine a couple of months ago tell me that he had seen this movie in theaters. I guess it had like a little run, maybe.
Might have.
I don't know. It's kind of an odd movie to just suddenly bring back into theaters, but I guess they have been doing that recently with, you know, the lack of product that they've had to deal with. But yeah. But he told me this is really good too, and I had never heard of it. And now that you've given a second recommend, I may have to watch it.
Yeah.
Goes on the list. Definitely goes on the list. I will say, I saw the poster and I thought, Jim Caviezel? Eric Roberts looks so much like Jim Caviezel on this poster.
Well, and Rebecca De Mornay is in this, and it was maybe 10 minutes before I realized it was her, because she's so, well, she plays a assistant train engineer. And I'm trying to find a tactful way to say they made her dirty, like literally dirty, not like Anyway, I didn't recognize her. Everybody's really young in this movie. But anyway, it was great. I love it. Mm-hmm.
Yep. My small recommend is I saw for the first time The Quick and the Dead from 1995. I remember hearing about this movie, and I remember most of the people in my immediate world were either like, this is the most amazing movie ever, or what were they thinking with this movie? I think the general consensus is moving towards this is the most amazing movie ever, and I totally understand why. I think it was just ahead of its time, and maybe the little bit of that is the way Sam Raimi and his kind of ostentatious editing has become more of an accepted norm tone, where it wasn't when he started doing this stuff. It was a really abstract, out there kind of tone. I think it really works in this movie. This is my favorite kind of Sam Raimi, in my opinion, where it's like in this really interested, textured Western idea, you've got great actors doing authentic performances, but the movie making makes it quirky. It's not that all the performances make it quirky or anything like that. It's the shot selection and the quick zooms and the complete overuse of the Hitchcock dolly zoom in that scene where, you know, he's aping the Clint Eastwood movies and everything, and yet still it kind of works. Like it's that thing that you know, Simon Pegg and Edgar Wright have done so well with, like, Hot Fuzz, where it's kind of making fun of the thing, but also is a great example of the thing. Like, it just kind of elevates the Western in some ways. This honestly is the, you know, the All Valley Gunslinger tournament. Like, that's all this really is. But the acting makes it so good. I haven't even mentioned to you who's in it. I mean, Oscar winners galore. You've got Gene Hackman, Russell Crowe, Leonardo DiCaprio. And then, of course, Sharon Stone is in it as well. Gary Sinise shows up for a cup of coffee. And then there's all these other people. You're like, oh, that's Lance Hendrickson. Oh, that's Tobin Bell. You know, there's just so many people who are in this. I didn't mention Keith David as well. Yeah. But it's a lot of fun. It has those occasional, are you kidding me, shots, you know, this is a blast. I just had a blast with this movie.
This is a movie I've seen 100 times at least. Yeah. Maybe 100 times. I'm probably overestimating it, but I was one of those back in 1995 championing this movie, and everybody would tell me, what, the Sharon Stone Western? Let's do stupid Sharon Stone Western. That's what they'd always say. Like, you obviously haven't seen this movie then, because it's pretty awesome. I was just thinking about the scene there with Gene Hackman and Keith David just before they go out to do their duel. And Gene Hackman comes up to him and tells him, you know, I know that you're the guy that was sent here to kill me and whatever. And there's rain coming down and everything. He goes, when the rain stops, I'm going to make an example of you. And Keith David gives this farty laugh, like, you're not going to kill me. And then they have the amazing duel afterwards. So anyway, I love that. So
yeah, it's awesome. I love it.
Yeah, the very young DiCaprio. We had a moment. I was watching this with my son and my wife and my brother, and we were having a good time. And that's another part of it too, probably, like watching it with people and just laughing and having fun. And it got to the moment where Sharon Stone wins a duel and then kisses Leonardo DiCaprio on the lips. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those moments where I was like, you know, you could play the gender reversal here, like, and how icky that would be. And then we paused it and had this deep discussion on power dynamics and why one way makes sense and the other way doesn't. And like, it was, you know, when the quick and the dead can lead to philosophical discussion, you know, you're having a good night. So we had a fun time.
I think it's a perfect age, like DiCaprio. If he's older, he can't play this role, right?
No,
whole thing is that he's too young for this, but brash enough to think he's not. It's perfect age for him to play this role.
Yeah, totally.
I think he was like roughly 20 when he shot this. So, I got off of the Criterion Channel. I watched Le Samurai, a French movie from Jean-Pierre Melville, and this is a very, very simple premise, but I think I always enjoy heist movies and assassin movies and stuff like that, where the person is so professional, sets up a plan that you can follow and that you're just like, okay, yeah. But in movie world, it still goes wrong for some reason. And that's why we're watching the movie, right? And this is one of those where the right off the beginning, our lead character, who is a hired killer, is laying all the groundwork for his alibi, and he's making sure that everything goes well for the guy he has to kill later. But a couple of mistakes are made, and he's spotted at the place where he does the killing. And for the most of the remainder of the movie, it's almost like a cop procedural type thing. The cops are very sure it's him because of some of the witnesses, what they've described. Some witnesses don't recognize him. Some are sure it's him. And they do a lot of like fun things to try to make sure that nobody's biased in their opinion of who it is and everything. But meanwhile, our main guy just barely, you know, he's just barely free, basically. Like they don't have him on enough evidence. So he gets to go back home. Meanwhile, the people who hired him to do the killing, they're a little upset that there was any kind of trouble whatsoever, and they want to make sure that he dies. So now he's got to battle the cops who were trying to catch him, and he's got to battle the people who hired him in this thing so that he doesn't die or whatever. And it leads to a tremendous climax and everything. I highly recommend this. I know, Aaron, this is way up your alley. And nice. Jeremy, I think you would like it too, but I really do think this is kind of a, like, this is like an Aaron movie if I ever saw one.
I'm intrigued.
So I think that you would very much like this. You don't see movies like this anymore, obviously, but
I like the French language. I'm assuming that is the samurai in French. I like the French language. It's either like
it's a good assumption,
or it's basically the same thing as an English word.
Yeah. Like, well, as taking 4 years of French attests, I don't understand what they're saying most of the time either. But I do find it fun catching things that they say in the dialogue and going, oh, okay, yeah, I know that's exactly what that meant on the subtitle and everything. And then there's some times where I'm like, but I thought that word meant this, and you realize that subtitle writers sometimes will change it just to make it different for some reason. I don't know. Anyway, very, very good movie. You can find it on Criterion. I think you'll like it.
I'm gonna have to. This may put me over the edge to sub to the Criterion channel. I can't believe I haven't done it yet. I really should. It seems like there's so much classic stuff on there.
I will say, I think I watched this on Max. Now Max has some sort of like crossover, obviously, because you got a lot of the same companies involved and things. But I do believe it's on both. So, I believe I saw it on Max. But anyway, there you go. Nice. On to our big recommend, which is Your Name, and it's Aaron's. So Aaron, take it away.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
Your Name, period, as Chris said. So actually I said that too excited. Your Name is the name of the movie. It is a Japanese anime from 2016 from director Makoto Shinkai, I believe is how you pronounce his name. He's been directing animated films in Japan since the 1900s.
Wow.
Well, 1998. But yes, technically the 1900s. Yes. Still after 18 years, this movie became his widest success. So he'd been in the industry quite a while before this movie kind of popped for him worldwide, as opposed to just in Japan. The movie starts with some gorgeous animation of what appears to be a meteor falling to Earth through some clouds. The meteor is spotted by a busy metropolis in a city around a lake. A young man and a young woman talk about the strange feelings that started the day the sky fell. We get a sense that they're connected, but before we get too lost in how that might be, we're thrown full on into an opening expositional theme song that includes the amazing line, "We'll high-five love we've yet to discover and give a kiss to time." God bless subtitles when they include the lyrics to music. Love that line. And then it finishes with "Chasing After Your Name," allowing us to roll some early pop music credits. Mitsuha is her name, and she dreams of the two of them meeting and then getting separated at a train station just before she wakes up and immediately starts groping herself. Not because it was that kind of dream, but because we quickly realized that Mitsuha has been whatever the Japanese word for Freaky Friday'd is, and may not be Mitsuha at all.
It's called giving a kiss to time.
Yes, exactly. A quick cut to the next morning at breakfast, and Mitsuha seems to be back to herself, but unaware of what happened the previous day, but still aware enough to turn on the television for some good old anime-style news position about the coming comet. Mitsuha does her hair up in the string we saw from the dream, and we're off to experience her daily life by the city by the lake. She meets some friends for a nice inconsiderate stroll down the middle of the road and passes a mayoral candidate giving a roadside speech that he pauses long enough to chide her for her posture because he's her dad. Dads, am I right? At school, she finds the phrase, "Who are you?" in her notebook, and we continue to get clues that yesterday was weird and there's some sort of ritual coming up that she is anxious about. After taking a bit of time to hear her friends ponder their futures on a bench by the lake, we cut to Mitsuha learning the art of weaving thread at the shrine, but we get a sense that her skills aren't the only things that loom in her future. It's then on to a ritual where we learn the oh-so-appetizing way that her special sake is made. Hint, it's chewed-up rice spit. After shouting to the heavens about how much she hates her life, she asks no one in particular to make her a handsome boy in Tokyo in her next life. Cut to a handsome boy in Tokyo falling out of a bed where his alarm goes off. After immediately groping himself, still not in that way, we quickly realize that Taki has been whatever the Japanese words for changed upped are and may not be Taki at all. Mitsuha, as Taki, learns what it's like to have guy pals, the cost of breakfast in Tokyo, and that they work as a server at a restaurant that makes some fabulous-looking toothpick pizza. He then asks a young woman he works with to take off her skirt, but only so he can sew a hedgehog onto it. Before falling asleep, Mitsuha writes her name on his hand because if they're going to keep entering each other's bodies, they should probably know each other's names. It's then montage time as the two communicate more through body art, rebellion, and another expositional pop song that allows them to lay down some ground rules like no baths, no looking, and no touching, which is clearly terrible hygiene, and they both need to rethink the real-life consequences of their sexual repression. Definitely. On a trip with Grandma to the local asteroid crater, we then learn about Musabi, the representation of relationships, time, and existence, how things are changed or combined, why that's important, and a metaphorical thread for the rest of the movie is born. Taki then wakes up crying and finds out that Mitsuha has set up a date for him with Hedgehog Skirt Girl, but he's awkward and spends most of the early date putting his attempt, putting his armpit in her face in a crowded elevator. Then in an art gallery, he sees a picture of Mitsuha's lake town in, isn't that strange? After the date, he reads that it will be about time for the comet on his phone and finds Mitsuha in his phone as a number. He calls, and then we cut to Mitsuha, who has cut her hair to go and watch the comet, which is now two comets that cause something strange to happen inside of her pupil. We cut back to Taki, whose phone call is a dead number, and the voiceover confirms they never switched places again. At this point, the body swap movie becomes a Sherlock Holmes mystery, with Taki drawing pictures from memory of where Mitsuha lives so that he can find her. He thinks he's figured it out, and his friends surprise him and come along to see if he's lost his mind and why he gets so annoyed when people get excited about life-size mascots. After they stop for some ramen, the staff at the diner is helpful enough to let him know the town he drew was Itamori, but also that, dun dun dun, Itamori was destroyed by the comet 3 years ago. After his messages app gets the Marty McFly Polaroid treatment, he and his friends find a list of the victims that include his body swap partner, Mitsuha. His memories start to fade, and he convinces himself that he saw the news footage and must have made up the story based on that, but a braided bracelet that is both literal and metaphorical won't let him forget, so he's off on another field trip, this time alone. He then treks through the cinematically mandated rain to the crater where his not-grandma told him about the underworld, also that he could drink some three-year-old spit sake and go on an acid trip. Acid reflux trip? That is a montage of Mitsuha's life that is so beautiful you can't believe it doesn't include the strains of Billie Eilish pondering what she was made for. The trip ends with him begging her to get out of there before the meteor strikes, and wait a second, dun dun dun, He's Mitsuha again on the day of the meteor, and this Sherlock Holmes mystery has now become an action survival film, with Mitsuha now trying to save the town from destruction. The plan involves an easily hacked town communication system and some explosives, but first, a trip to see Daddy Mayor, but the only help he offers is to put Mitsuha in psychiatric care. Dads, am I right? He's having a hard time convincing anyone that something is happening, but with some help from his younger sister, he has two simultaneous revelations: that Mitsuha, as him, must have awoken to realize the destruction has happened, and also that she visited Tokyo the day before she died to try to find him. He also realizes that it was her that gave him the bracelet he wears 3 years before he even knew who she was. We then cut to the crater rim, where Taki and Mitsuha can sense each other through time, but can't see each other until twilight happens. The time of day, not the shiny vampire movie. But either way...
Or the Reese Witherspoon movie.
The Reese Witherspoon movie.
I like how you called it the Reese Witherspoon movie when, like, isn't Gene Hackman and Paul Newman in that
it's
movie?
Gene Hackman and Paul Newman, but Reese Witherspoon's funnier.
Oh, no, he is.
But either way, it gives them their moment, at least until the sun descends and the moment is unceremoniously ended because Elton John wasn't there to beg for it not to happen.
There you go.
He then tries to Destiny's Child her into his memory, but it's already faded and he has nothing left to do but scream the lyrics to the theme song from CSI into the sky forlornly. But we cut back to Mitsuha, who is in full action mode, and the plan is working as they cut the power and get the alarms going, and everyone is leaving until her dad shuts it all down and tells everyone to stay put. Mayors, am I right? With time running out, she runs and trips and remembers that his name is on her hand, except it isn't his name. It's just the words, "I love you." That's a dumb move, by the way. So she runs to confront her dad, and we cut to the comet we've already seen, but this time we see it land, and we see the massive devastation to the town that it causes. We then cut to 5 years later, and Taki is searching for a person, a place, a job he doesn't know, but he does know that red ribbons give him special feels, and that he's drawn to that town that was destroyed by the meteor and the strange mystery of how most of the town actually survived. That's right. Mitsuha must have convinced her dad to save the townspeople and keep thousands from dying. Dads, am I right? We then see the two of them searching for each other without actually searching for each other until finally they pass each other on the stairs, and he works up the courage to use the oldest line in the history of pickup lines, "Hey, don't I know you?" But in this case, it happens to also be true, and she says, "I was thinking the same thing." They both then channel Eminem by ending the movie with a final, "Your name is?"
"My name is."
And that's your name. What did you guys think? My impression is that this is the first time for both of you guys. So what were your thoughts on Your Name?
It was the first time, and I ended up watching it a second time because I wanted to know what was going on. And even after the second time, I'm glad that you went through a summary because there were a couple of things that I wasn't too sure about even after watching it twice. Obviously, this movie is terrific. There's no doubt about it. There's a lot of nice meanings and stuff in this. I like the idea that the dream ends when you fall asleep. I think that's a really interesting concept. There's a point where her grandmother tells her to, when they're going to the shrine and they're bringing the sake, she says, "To get back to this life, you must leave behind what's important to you." And that's exactly how she gets back to the life. I thought that was awesome. And you mentioned that the twilight is when they're able to see each other at the shrine site. I thought that was cool too, especially since they had described what twilight was, earlier in the movie as well. The thing that stands out to me the most in this movie is the animation. There's a lot of just really cool stuff in here. Almost every sliding door that happens, I believe every sliding door that happens is right on the, it's like as if you were inside the door and the door comes towards you every time. I think that's a really nice touch. There's a point where, Mitsuha's friends, come by on a bike and there's all the bushes fly by in the foreground as they approach her towards the beginning of the movie. I love the part where they go to the Italian restaurant and all the stuff has happened. And there's like this sort of break in the action. And there's just a shot of this light in the foreground with the fans spinning. That's just the shot that they've chosen to do for an establishing thing after all the thing with the toothpick and the pizza and everything. Mm-hmm. Love the moon behind the converging power lines. That's a really cool shot. I think it's really awesome that the second crater turns Itamori's lakes into a Mobius strip, which I am assuming is not accidental. I'm assuming that they meant for it to look like that Mobius strip, that infinity symbol. I thought that was a really nice touch. Other stuff like the reflections of the trees on the car when the guy drives him out to Itamori or to the shrine, that born again sequence, when it goes back in time and we see the sperm hitting the egg and see that whole of her life unfolding in front of his eyes and everything, I think is great. And then, I also love that shot when she's going to Tokyo and she's looking out the window of the train and it goes into a tunnel and we see her reflection pop up as soon as she goes into the tunnel. So there's a lot of like just really cool things like that in it. And this story is awesome as well. I mean, it's one of those like, huh? Whoa, what? Huh? It was there talking to each other 3 years apart. Oh, wow. That's intriguing. And yeah, I love all of that. So yeah, this is a great movie. It's well deserving of its reputation.
I specifically wrote down that the movie is visually breathtaking at times. And you wrote specific shots, and I'm glad you mentioned them. But the sequence when they go with the grandmother for the first time up the mountain, up the crater to the shrine, there's a lot of incredible animation in that sequence alone of the forest and the leaves. Mm-hmm. And then the movie keeps pulling focus at different times the way like an actual film would, but you don't see a lot in animated movies. I really felt like that was immersive. It helped me live in that world. I think the movie's biggest selling point is how surprising it is. And it reminded me of Parasite in that way, and only that way, in that it continued to reach the place I thought the whole movie was going to be and then go somewhere new. It did that two or three different times. Going in and after the first 10 minutes, I thought, okay, so this movie's going to be them trying to figure out what's happening and why they're switching bodies. Well, no, that's over like 30 minutes in and it becomes a completely different story. And the movie kept me on my toes in that way, which I really appreciated. And I think I look for that more and more because all three of us have seen so many movies. There are so many tropes and worn valleys that we've seen movies go through. When something fresh happens, it stands out even more. The mostly piano score was a little jarring for me. I'm sure this is a cultural thing. Same with the pop songs that were used. Now, I should state right now that I'm angry at Amazon. I ended up watching a dubbed version because Amazon wasn't clear about what I was buying. And I had already bought for $5 and started watching when I realized, oh, this is the dubbed version. I'm not going to go buy it again. But reading the comments and listening to you guys, I do think there are parts of this movie that I caught more than people who didn't watch the dub version because it laid out so much of it in English. I also want to challenge the part where he didn't write his name because both Aaron and the chat were saying that was a dumb move. And I'm here to tell you that made me cry.
I get it. I totally get it.
That is what he is saying with that is that is more important than telling her his name. Is telling her he loves her. And it broke me in half. Yeah. I don't know what it says about where I am in my life, but I did not want them to get together at the end. Mm. When they are on two different trains and the tracks are veering and they see each other, I was like, perfect. Go to black right now. They're separating. They're in the same city. They were that close, but they're not going to get it. But the movie probably has to go where it goes and put them back together in the same space and time, but I wanted a gut punch there for some reason. I wanted it to break me.
Isn't that interesting too, by the way? When I first watched it, I was like, what the fuck? Just go up there and talk to her. What are they doing walking past each other and everything? But if you watch this movie going, you know, like remember the things that happen in this movie, they often forget things mm-hmm. like immediately. Now, I don't know why they would forget after seeing each other, but you know, it's the way the movie, it's been consistent throughout that they're sitting there looking for each other after they get off the trains all this time. And I was like, and I realized that they had basically forgotten what they were looking for until they ran into each other on the stairs and then walked past each other. But the first time I watched this, I was like, what the fuck? You sat there and looked for them. You both look for each other this whole time. And now you're just like, eh, we'll walk past each other until somebody's brave enough to say something. So anyway,
I had the same feeling, Jeremy, when I watched this, and I think there's a modern sensibility that is really open to that kind of ending, that this movie almost subverts in some way. I think this movie does earn its ending. I don't feel like it's a bad ending, but
I agree.
There is a very much La La Land past lives kind of ending that could be to this as well. There's a lot of past lives, actually. There's a lot of the themes in this are very similar to past lives. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that ending also would have worked for me as well. But I think they earn the ending they go with, in my opinion.
I think they do.
You guys mentioned so many of the things that I would bring up, so I just have a couple to mention. The running gag about him grabbing her boobs is the funniest thing in the movie to me, because every time you think the movie is going to have him actually deal with it, he actually doesn't. Even when he's weeping with emotion, yeah. The first thing he does when he wakes up is feel the boobs. Like, it just slayed me every time.
I appreciate that the movie just allowed kids to be horny for once,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Like, I've never had a movie make me cry that used the word boobies so many times.
Yeah, that's true.
Fair enough. You obviously weren't paying close enough attention to Finding Nemo, but that's fine. There are some moments in this movie that still shock me every time I watch it. The pen drop moment shocks me every time I watch this movie.
It's such a great
so
moment.
Good. It's so well done, and it feels out of nowhere. Foreshadowing for, like, nobody previously in the movie is like, but when Twilight is over, things immediately change, you know, like, right. There's no, it just does it to you, and yep. It's like, oh my goodness. So yeah, I wanted to bring the pin drop moment up, and then yeah, you mentioned most of the shots I wanted to mention except for the umbilical cord, which I thought was a really beautiful tie-in to the theme of how things are threaded, you know, a mother and a child. Mm-hmm. You know, they exist together as the same, but not the same. And life is between them, and time passes between, like, just the idea of how the world, like the philosophy this movie has about how the world works through, the thread of time and the thread of relationships it's really beautiful. So, yeah.
There are a couple others too to talk about. Like, I love the fact that there's this, and I didn't really pay much attention to the lyrics, so maybe this song was being sad all this whole time. But just before the meteor hits the earth, there's that, you know, that happy sounding song anyway, mm-hmm.
yeah.
going on, and then it just stops abruptly, or just kind of stops, and then the meteor comes down, and that crash is so insane, so well done, and everything. The sound and the visuals on that are amazing. And the other thing, Jeremy was talking about, the when they see each other on the trains at the end, I really enjoyed too, was that they see each other, they're locked in their gaze, and then, like, very rudely, the trains go behind a barrier, and you hear this, you know, like that, and then that's when they're on that separate ways thing at that point, trying to find each other and everything.
That's my final thing I will mention, and everybody, this happened to me while I was watching the movie. Everybody can take it for whatever it is. I'm not trying to put any extra meaning on it whatsoever, but when, this will take a little bit of intro, when we go through the winter, we make actual fires in our fireplace. We like to put actual logs in and burn them. It's like, you know, it's I'm a little bit of a pyro, and it gives me that outlet. So mm-hmm. I had a fireplace yesterday because it was the one time since the middle of February that it was cold enough to make a fire, because mm-hmm. it's been unseasonably warm. There's always one log at the front of the fire, the way that I make it, that just doesn't burn all the way. Right? And it just sits there in the hot coals for a while, and then eventually it'll burn. So the fire had been out for about an hour, and the moment when they are in the trains looking at each other and the trains go apart, that log burst into flame just out of nowhere after an hour of being dead. And I was like, wow, nice effects, universe slash God slash whatever you want to say. coincidence, whatever. But it was one of those moments where you're like, oh, that was interesting. Anyhow, it just happened right at that moment. It just kind of shocked me in the room.
Man, you said you're a bit of a pyro, and you reminded me real quick, sorry, Chris, of the Giovanni Ribisi's short run on Friends where he plays Phoebe's brother. Uh-huh. and he's a pyro. And at one point she says, I don't know anything about you. And he's like, yeah, well, remember how I told you I like to burn stuff? Oh, I hate stuff that doesn't burn. All right.
Okay. So what's our super secret double feature going to be like?
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
We already discussed last night how similar this movie is to The Lake House and how much we don't like The Lake House. And the chat has already mentioned The Lake House.
Yes.
So I did have a tough time with this because it is so many different kinds of movies in one. There's not really any other movie like it. Mm-hmm. So I can look at time travel. I can look at body swaps. I can look at supernatural. And so I went with something that I think has some interesting examination and humanity and relationships and friendships. It does have some swapping and some Southeast Asia. And I'm going with Colossal as my super secret double feature.
There you go.
Love it.
Anne Hathaway, Dan Stevens, and Jason Sudeikis and Tim Blake Nelson, where at a playground somewhere in, I think it's Canada, she finds that she is transported to South Korea and is a huge kaiju. The movie sounds like a lark, but it is dark if you haven't seen it. I just think it would thematically be a very interesting pairing with Your Name. And I slept on it and I woke up feeling very, very happy with that pick.
That's a great choice. Was almost my big recommend for this week.
Oh, wow.
Colossal.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Well, yeah, like, the log just burst into flames again.
Yeah, it's funny. Jeremy gets on our Slack and says, Aaron's always finding those movies where we can't come up with a super secret double feature. Of course, I end up, you know, we end up naming like five movies by the end of it. But the funny thing is that I said, I've got two good ones and I got one bad one. And the bad one is The Lake House. And Jeremy's like, oh no, that's the one that I was going to pick. And, going back and looking at The Lake House, I didn't realize at the time or until I just looked it up that it was a remake of a Korean film called Il Mare.
Oh, wow.
And I went and watched Il Mare that night, last night, in fact, watched that movie, which is, it's way better than The Lake House. And it goes with this movie extremely well. And I would like to do that one, but I had two in my mind, and I'm gonna go with Being John Malkovich on this one.
That's good.
You know, where you have not only the body swap but gender swap type of things going on, and how you feel when you're inside, especially the different characters feel when they are inside John Malkovich, throughout that whole movie and everything. And so I thought that was a good one. The other one that I thought of, which also has sort of that time travel, let's see if we can fix the past type thing, is Frequency.
Yeah, I thought of that too.
Which is another one where you do that. There's no body swapping there, but you do have, you know, you do have a radio broadcast that is connected through, I don't remember how it was, like 20 years of time, 30 years of time. You know, Caviezel is trying to right some wrongs that happened in the past and everything. But I'm going to go with Being John Malkovich as my super secret double feature. I think that goes well. All those other ones that I mentioned would go well too, since we're cheating. So there you go.
I had Frequency written down as well. I think that's a really good match too. You made it tough, Aaron, but we brought it.
It's Chris, my favorite thing. No, both of those choices are great. I love them both.
All right. So next week's homework, Jeremy's turn to come up with a movie.
A movie.
And what will you be? What will you be sending our way this time?
Folks, we're gonna watch 2011's Warrior with Tom Hardy and Joel Edgerton. Mm. It is on the surface an MMA movie, but it is so much more than that. It is
a good one.
Relationships with our fathers, our brothers, our wives, our bosses. Kevin Dunn once again almost steals a movie. He plays the principal. He's not really in very many scenes, but he's fucking funny. I love this movie. I don't give a rat's ass about MMA. So hopefully if you're in that same boat, you'll give it a shot. There's you'll get your MMA action if you really want to see kicking and boxing and wrestling. It's there, but I think the movie is trying to say a lot more, and I really, really like it. It is for free on Netflix. It is on Plex for free, and it is on Amazon Prime with a premium subscription. So there you go.
All right. Okay, looks like we got some time for some questions.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I'm listening.
Any questions? Yeah, don't watch Warriors on accident. Yeah, the chat is reminding me. That's a good movie, but a completely different film.
It's very, very different. Yes.
Soon to be a Lin-Manuel Miranda musical.
You mentioned that. Yeah, we should also mention there is a live action remake, of course, of Your Name in production right now, because of course there is.
Is it an American production?
I believe so. Yes.
No.
You know what?
Is it going to be Chalamet?
I was watching this thinking that this is primed to get remade. I actually felt like, I don't know, I felt like it was okay for it to get remade, even though.
I have less issues, especially cross-culturally. Like there's some interesting things that can happen when you take a movie across cultures. If it's good, it's good. I'm always a wait and see guy though. Well, I'm always put it in front of me. So
I will say it is Bad Robot. So I tend to be a J.J. Abrams fan. He, in my opinion, at least tries to put some thought into, oh boy, that makes me nervous though. If it ends up.
Yeah.
And marketed like Tristan and Isolde, only with body clapping.
Tristan and Isolde. What a movie. What a pull. Tristan and Isolde.
That's for all you. I don't know why that was cut deep to my mind, but it did.
Amazing.
All right. We definitely have time for some questions.
Yep.
Any questions? With Twister being remade, I actually think it's a sequel. What's the best disaster movie? The Day After Tomorrow has always been my guilty pleasure, says the question asker.
This movie, I don't know if you would want to consider it a disaster movie because there's actually no disaster on screen. But back in 1964, there were two competing nuclear war movies, and one was Dr. Strangelove, and the other one was Failsafe. Hmm. Failsafe is a movie about what if certain things went wrong, but they take it way more seriously. In fact, there was lawsuits over these two movies. One is Kubrick trying to beat this movie to the punch and everything. There was all sorts of stuff going on, but this takes a more serious look at what if something went wrong with your computer system and you thought that Russia was about to launch an attack. And then you did the unthinkable and attacked, even though you yourselves weren't attacked. And it's got an ending that I don't want to ruin for you if you've never seen Failsafe, but the decisions that are made at the end of that movie are devastating. It's going to leave you with a really sour taste in your mouth by the end of it. One of those type of things was that right? Was that the right thing to do? I don't know. Maybe it's the right thing to do. Oh, that's so bad though. And so that's what I'm going to go with on my disaster movie.
Fascinating. Fascinating. In college, my buddy Josh and I went through, and our friend Andrew went through classic disaster movie binge. So we went and read it all the ones from like the 70s, like Towering Inferno and Poseidon Adventure and Airport 77 and all these movies. I like the Towering Inferno best, even though it's hard for me to watch because I don't like heights and tall buildings. And then you throw fire into that. It actually makes me nervous. Poseidon Adventure doesn't make me nervous because I'm never going to be in the middle of an ocean on a big boat. It's just not going to happen. Mm-hmm. But I might end up in a tall building someday. Maybe the Paul Newman-ness of it. Poseidon Adventure has Gene Hackman. They're both pretty great, but I like Towering Inferno the best.
If you want comedy, read the Pauline Kael review of the Towering Inferno. That is amazing.
That's too bad. I mean,
of course she did.
If I'd seen it when it came out, I might not have liked it. But
you did hear him say Pauline Kael, right? Of course she hated it. I'm going with Airport, one that you mentioned in group. No, you just mentioned it. Now, if I was going with Poseidon Adventure, then I'd be really ticked at you.
Of course, stealing someone. Mm-hmm. Yep.
I really liked Airport. I too, much more recently, went through a lot of the old classic. In Towering Inferno was great too, but there's something about the way that Airport sets its characters up and does the multiple storyline thing that I didn't realize, you know, was something that predated the 90s. You know what I mean? Like, there's a really interesting way that it deals with, you know, this disaster. And I just like the characters. I like Burt Lancaster in this, I think, is really, really good. Dean Martin is fun in this movie. Jacqueline Bisset. It's a lot of fun, and the characters are really good. And I love some of the moments and the beats and how the story unfolds.
I like the shouting and the beats.
Yeah,
that's right.
Over in the chat, Slab says Airplane, which honestly, that would probably be my favorite if
it's hard to watch Airport after Airplane exists, because it's a direct parody in so many ways.
For sure. Castro says, my answer is still Don't Look Up. James says, quite honestly, it might be Your Name for me. Totally makes sense. And then we have 28 Days Later from Jets Mets. 8 says The Core, Armageddon, and Volcano are fun. Well, yeah, I'll give you some of that. Some of that I'll give you. I don't think I like any of them. Oh, but you know what? Volcano is kind of like nutty. It's a nutty movie. There's no doubt about it.
They all look the same.
Yeah. It's so amazing.
Volcano cured racism.
Yes, it did. It sure did. Got to vote for War Games in there. That's a good one.
I think it,
even if there's not an actual disaster that happens, the threat of it is just as powerful, I think, a lot of times. Greenland was surprisingly good. Yeah, I don't remember if I saw that movie. It may have been in the middle of like a million movies I watched in one day get a year end done. I've heard that you like it.
It's enjoyable. It's probably it's one good. Of the higher quality Gerard Butler movies. I still would rather watch, Jamie Foxx. Fuck.
You'd rather watch Jamie Foxx do what?
Law Abiding Citizen.
Oh, okay. Oh, yes.
But that movie's not good. Right. I think Greenland is actually pretty good.
Yeah. Slab also says Knowing, and then we've got an Independence Day in there, and so on and so forth. A lot of stuff. Anyway, go ahead.
I can't remember which one has Pierce Brosnan in it of the volcano movies that came out Dante's Peak. I think Dante's Peak was the first movie I saw in a theater with you at a preview showing at the theater were working at when I was in college. I remember watching that with you.
That's funny that you would remember that. I don't remember that. All right, on to another question. We all have lists of shame, yes? Well, yes. What would you say is the best movie you have yet to see? It's hard to judge because we haven't seen them, but let's take a crack at it, gents.
There's one movie that a lot of filmmakers swear by, especially Spielberg, that I've never seen. I think I started it and watched about 20 minutes of it one day and I never got through it, but it's The Searchers.
John Wayne.
Yeah. It's a movie that apparently when Spielberg, I'm trying to remember which movie he was doing. Like maybe it was Duel or something. He said he watched The Searchers like 30 times or something. Wow. And prepped to direct Duel or something like that. So anyway, that's probably on my list of shame. That's probably my top movie on my list of shame. I'll probably remedy that this year now that I'm saying it out loud.
Aaron.
Yeah, you're right. It's a weird question because you don't necessarily know what the best you haven't seen is. So I went to Letterboxd and just clicked on some of like the best lists. And according to Letterboxd, the movie is probably Perfect Blue. At least that's the most popular movie that I haven't seen. It's a 1997 anime. And so it has a lot of fans. According to the Sight and Sound list that comes out every so often, every decade, I think, it's probably Tokyo Story. I haven't seen Tokyo Story. Probably need to get around to that. And according to IMDb rankings, it's Cinema Paradiso would be the best.
I can vouch for Cinema Paradiso.
So can I. You will love that.
So there you go.
I mean, I know any projectionist probably loves that movie, but movie lovers in general probably love
it. So when you watch Cinema Paradiso, Aaron, you will be like, oh, so that's where Babylon got it.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. All of a sudden, my love for Babylon will just tank.
It'll be totally tanked.
I think I have to say Gone with the Wind. I still haven't seen Gone with the Wind. No motivation to see Gone with the Wind. I know it's on all the classics lists. There's probably a better movie that I haven't seen.
Definitely.
In terms of like class, that's just where my brain went immediately, because it's the one that stands out that I've never seen.
And Gone with the Wind is more outdated than you will ever realize. Like, it's one of those that's just like insane. I've seen that movie probably three times. I saw it in theaters when it came out at Hollywood 27. And it was a re-release, so I have seen it in theaters. We had to do some weird shit with our projectors to run it too, because we had to like block off a whole bunch of the window to show proper format and everything. But don't be ashamed that you haven't seen that movie.
All right. I'll try and come up with a better answer for later then.
Over in the chat, we have Godfather 2. I would say some people think Godfather 2 is better than the first one, so you would definitely want to watch that one. I think they're equal, but the Godfather 2 is like almost a completely different, like watching a completely different movie. And it's just as good as the first one. James says, I somehow have never seen Ghostbusters yet. I can vouch for Ghostbusters. Ghostbusters is good. Slab says Godfather 1 and 2, The Thing, Interstellar, and Seven Samurai. Tell you what, Slab, carve yourself out some time and watch all those movies, but especially The Thing. You're going to have a lot of fun with The Thing. The Thing is such a good movie. Treat yourself, as they said in Parks and Recreation, and watch The Thing. It's so good. Then we have All Quiet on the Western Front. We have Perfect Blue. We have The Raid 2. Talk about treat yourself, man. Raid 2 is amazing. And then we have Psycho. Lawrence of Arabia totally can vouch for that movie. Lawrence of Arabia is a must watch, and it's just such a beautiful movie. Even though it's like it takes forever, I don't think it really feels like forever. It's one of those type of movies,
unlike Dr. Zhivago.
Oh, Dr. Zhivago is a sleeping pill.
Yes.
I love what Slab says. What makes The Godfather so shameful for him is that he's owned every single format it's been released in and still hasn't seen it. He's bought every physical copy.
That's a movie fan right there.
that's awesome. Movie fan.
Yes, that is amazing.
Amazing.
Okay, maybe one more. We have room for one more.
I think we need one more. Did a movie ever make you want to go to a place? Like, did a movie ever accidentally serve as a travel ad for a city or a country that you ended up wanting to visit?
Oh, by far and away, Lost in Translation for Japan.
Good call.
Not only just going through the streets of Tokyo and all the different things that they experience in that, the food, the karaoke, all these different things, but Scarlett Johansson, while her husband Giovanni Ribisi is gone off doing photo shoots and probably fucking Anna Faris or whatever, there's a number of moments where she goes off into the country, and there's so many beautiful places that she visits in those montages and everything that I felt like Lost in Translation was a perfect Japan travelogue.
Good answer.
I think Lost is an easy answer. I mean, that's a TV show, but also Jurassic Park was filmed at the same place Lost was. This place called Kualoa Ranch, and it's just absolutely gorgeous there. Did finally get a chance to see that. The more interesting answer for me is also a TV show that I didn't really watch much of called Lupin, but I watched enough of it that it takes place in this seaside town that I have to go there someday. Like it's a place called Aratat, and it's in France. It's on the northern coast of France. And there's this little beach area that you come down from the town in, and then there's all these like white cliff, you know, cut out by the sea behind you, and then there's this arch at the left. Like it's the most beautiful beach I've ever seen. So I have a feeling someday, if I get a chance, I would love to stroll on that beach and just see it with my own eyes. Because it's amazing how much better stuff is in person than on video. Like just seeing things in real 3D space is just astonishing. So
I forgetting Sarah Marshall from the moment I saw it has made me want to go to Hawaii in general, and that Turtle Bay resort they shot at specifically. But I this is not the face of a man who's ready to make that flight. for some reason, I'm okay on a plane 5 hours from one side of America to the other, but over water, I would be that guy who has a panic attack and they have to turn the jet around and everybody gets mad at him. So I wrote in my notes, I have some anxiety mountains to climb before I can fly to Hawaii. But that movie definitely made me want to go there for sure.
Over in the chat, we have some little limited ones, but some people, you kind of want to go to Texas and Kansas. I don't know if that's a joke or whatever, but yeah, I can see that. If it might feel like an exotic place from wherever you're at. James says that all of the, I think it's Laika, right? It's Laika stop motion movies have made me want to see Portland, Oregon, the city the studio is in. And then Nick says there's a movie on Hulu written and directed by Seth Green called Changeland and set in Thailand and makes me want to go there for how beautiful it was. And Cry in the Dark made me want to visit Australia, not because I wanted I want a dingo to eat my baby, but because of the natural beauty. Yes, there you go. All right, thank you so much, chat, for coming out and watching us on a Tuesday. Next week's homework is Warrior. I can't wait to revisit this. I haven't seen it since it came out. So,
awesome.
So, this will be great. Anyway, that's going to do it for this episode. We'll see you next time. See ya.
Bye guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
Hello. You sound like you're from London.
Well, I'm not.
Shop around. Shop around.
Shop up. Shop up and shop down. Uh-huh. Yep.
Shop around.
Is something like that happened? Somebody else bought the ticket, got credit for it before you did, and then suddenly when it came time to deliver the tickets, I was like, oh, I don't have enough tickets.
My ticket reservoir has been depleted.
I went to this is the first time I had seen this new system of, like, you know, where you put your phone underneath the laser and they shoot the barcode from that or whatever.
Sure, yeah.
We went to New York a couple of years ago and went to a variety of games. Went to a Knicks game, went to a Rangers game, all that type of stuff. And this is the first time I've ever seen this system, and you don't know exactly how to put your phone underneath this thing. Mm-hmm. But these ushers, who are, of course, they're New Yorkers too. They are very impatient when people are going through the doors and everything, like, just stick it under there. Just stick it under there. Blah, blah, blah. Well, yeah, just stick it under there is what I already knew. Now, funny. I'm still very much the use the paper tickets. I mean, they can still, it's the barcode still on that.
Yeah.
They can still put it on that same thing. But every time I see people putting the phone on, I'm like, yeah, that's right. We're in 2023 or 24 or whatever.
Yes.